So now's the opportunity to have a question time. Our speakers have been wonderfully punctual under a slight pressure, but we now have time for some questions, and there's one, two, three. Let's take three, and then we'll have a response from the panel, and then we'll go another round of three. Could we have the first one, please?
I'd like to raise an issue provoked by Professor Hausmann's very stimulating talk. Sure, we need 100 specialists, put them together to make a product, but somebody has to orchestrate all that. And this is a real challenge in things like looking at the future energy mix and energy policy. You need the specialists who know everything there is to be known about photovoltaics, but we need people who know a little bit about all the technologies. They know about energy economics, energy policy, human behavior, also know about water and food resources that are related, and think about it in a systems way. And my question is, how are we going to produce those people? We need more of them desperately. I think we have to train them to know something in depth and then broaden them out, but I don't know how. We need more people in those areas who really are capable of taking a broad systems approach, and it's a big challenge.
Thank you very much. That was Chris Llewellyn Smith from the UK. If you'd just say your name and where you come from, please. The next one.
Well, I'm Imre Fronsky, earlier head of the Department of Innovation Management in Hungary. It's an old man, already pensioned. So my question is the following. We are like now the third phase of the historical dynamics of development of science and technology, and we can characterize it through the grand challenges, getting a dominating role in influencing science and technology development. What do you think about the needed changes to all speakers developing the cooperations in science, also utilizing the cooperation as a possibility, because what we inherited from the earlier period is the market-like collaboration of scientists, technologists, and so on, and obviously we need, to enrich this earlier frame with new types of collaboration, cooperation, and so on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the third.
Thank you.
The third question.
Yes, thank you. My name is Olman Segura from Costa Rica. Also, the question is to Mr. Hausmann. The man in the computer will not survive in the poll, but the Eskimos neither will survive in front of the computer. They both have their own knowledge, but a lot of their knowledge is tacit knowledge rather than codified and on the web. The problem is how to learn how much tacit knowledge they have, and because at the end of the talk you have measurements, how do you measure the tacit knowledge? And this is very good, very important for my second question, is the policy making. How to create the policy in favor of hundreds of PhDs, for instance, then going into codified knowledge, or more practical and technical institutes to learn some routines and competences that is tacit knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor
Hausmann. Thank you very much. It's a really great set of very related questions. The first question was, how do you orchestrate all this knowledge? How do we form the people that know about everything and put everything together? Well, that by definition cannot be. We're all limited individually to have one person bite. So there might be a role for individuals who understand a little bit of everybody else's person bites, but I don't think that we're going to find the superhuman. We have to start understanding that this is going to be an evolving outcome of interacting networks more than of great people who know everything because of our human limitations. And that's why we sort of split up into different communities, and evolution happens more gradually and more incoherently precisely because of that limitation. But definitely, I fully agree that we need people who specialize, whose specialty is putting person bites together, other people's person bites together. On the issue of grand challenges, I think that we're all finding ways in which we can nudge this network, this beast, in some directions. Mm-hmm. But I would like to stress that while these, challenges are a way of stimulating demand, it's not obvious what's happening on the supply side. That in many countries, and what's making hard life, the reason why developing countries didn't catch up and didn't just copy and follow, is that to make things, you need many pieces to be there. And in the absence of some pieces, you don't have incentives to accumulate the other pieces. Right? There's a coordination problem that unless, if you need two things to make something, well, providing one thing is not going to be particularly useful. So I think that the challenges are a good way to nudge the system on the demand side, but we need to think a little bit harder what's happening on the supply side. And with respect to the question on tacit knowledge, well, the way we measure knowledge is simply, I don't know what it is that you think you know, I just know what you do. And I'll try to infer what you know from what you do. Okay, and we have some techniques. The more things you do, the more you must know. The harder it is to make the things you do, the more knowledge they must involve. So we have a way of inferring the amount of knowledge that is embedded in products. Now, I fully agree with you that the advancement of things is done by taking tacit knowledge, trying to codify it, and trying to facilitate its transmission. The emphasis I wanted to make with the Inuits is that the total amount of knowledge in that society is low, even though the individuals of that society may individually hold a lot of knowledge, but the total amount of knowledge is low, and everybody shares it. Our secret of progress is that the total amount of knowledge is high, and we're all a bunch of ignorants that only hold a very, very small piece of it. And so we need to think of how it is that we spread that knowledge around and how it is that we re-aggregate it for use. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to just add to this because our talks were actually quite related. Professor Hausman was talking about productive knowledge in the brains, and I was talking about how those brains are circulating more than in the past. But on the first question of education and system thinking, let me just say that I think you're seeing the growth of several kinds of new education, often master's level education, and people, they call them T-shaped people, that have depth in one area and then can talk to people in other areas and can play that coordinating role. You see that at UC Berkeley, where I teach, you see it in the energy and resources area. In the information school where I work, we are training people to have depth in one area, but also to be able to work with the people who understand management or who understand a particular domain. So they may be information specialists, but they also may have deep domain knowledge in healthcare or water or whatever. So I think that, this is an interesting new time in education for creating cross-disciplinary people who can integrate. The other thing that's about education, the PhDs, I'm not sure if I understood the question, but I want to answer it slightly differently, which is, I think PhD programs, if they're hands-on, PhD programs in the sciences are always providing both codified and tacit knowledge. In order to work in a lab, you learn a lot of routines just through mentoring and through practice, and then it's codified. And let me just say that this whole trend towards specialization and the division of labor, which we discussed earlier within the workplace, one of the reasons that we can see the globalization that I described is because you're seeing the social division of labor. So the production of an iPad now involves, hundreds of producers, and they can be split geographically. You can coordinate it real time across great distances if it is codified. If it is completely codified, so you're seeing much, I think what we're seeing with the IT revolution is an increasing ability to codify what was formerly tacit knowledge. And so that's really pushing a lot of economic progress as well.
Thank you very much. That's very interesting questions and responses. Now, three more, please. Wow. two at the front here and one just behind. This is the take some from this side. Yes, that's all. Thank you.
Roger Beach in the U.S. I'd like to have Professor Hausman comment on the on whether or not the European way of creating innovation and productivity Will it yield more PKs or for the investment, or fewer PKs for the investment? And should they have studied your models before they designed their their programs?
Before the Eurozone collapses. Another question here.
Thank you. My name is Henry Zinochikiwe. I'm Minister of Science and Technology from Zimbabwe. But formally, my background is mathematics. I want to ask a question on biofuels cited in the last speaker's last transcript. We've heard the story of biofuel in terms of ethanol, Brazil, and many other countries. That's familiar now. Biofuel from corn, vegetable oil, and the various controversies associated with competition with food. If we put these aside, are there any other viable, therefore sustainable options for generating biofuel? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very sensitive question for Tanzania. Now, a question behind, please. Yes, this one here. Thank you.
Peter Tindemans from the Governing Board of Euroscience, the Netherlands. I notice in the presentation some tendency towards simplification, and I must say that will not help us, I gather, to solve these big challenges. I give two examples. Ricardo Hausmann, in his interesting story about the role of person bias and the need to combine these in organizations, I would like to ask him, where is the role of machines, of embodied technology, of capital in that story? Because that's a key factor, of course, in getting these human beings to get things done. And to Wolfgang Burche, isn't it a bit of chest-pounding to say that the European Framework Program is the biggest R&D program in the world, if we know that the NIH spends annually some $30 billion, and if we know that the European Space Agency spends something like 11 to 12 million, billion euros a year?
Professor Tomolin, on the biofuel question.
Well, this is a working group which is still working, and I have not detailed information what they will recommend. But certainly, we will advise only European parliamentarian and commission, and will not make a biofuel analysis of the world. Certainly, I know for Germany, and my academy has just will publish by the end of this year analysis about biofuel for Germany. We come to the conclusion that it's not worthwhile for us to do. So this will not be a way in which Germany could actually get energy from biofuel for driving cars. This will be probably out of the question for Germany. But what will this group recommend for Europe, we will see.
Just to add to that, I mean, there is the strong possibility that the advice that will be given on biofuels with respect to some countries in Europe is that we should not use crops which normally produce food for that purpose. We should use specifically biomass or waste materials. And that, of course, is a big debate at the moment in Europe. Professor Hausmann.
Let me go to the challenge of oversimplification. See, if you look around the world, I mean, I was trained as an economist. So economists believe that things are made with few things. They're made with capital, labor, machines, and so on. Everybody has a little bit of everything, so everybody should be able to make a little bit of everything, because you have what it takes to make everything. And my point is that you don't. That unless you have the right person bites, you can't make things. And when you look across the world, the majority of developing countries make amazingly few things. They make no machines. You mentioned machines. Machines embody knowledge about how to make things. So the machines are the embodiment of the knowledge of how to make things. Well, most countries don't make machines. They don't make chemicals. They don't make medicines. They don't make a large section of industrial output. So you ask yourself, why don't they? And the simplest answer is because they can't, because they don't have the productive knowledge that is involved in making them. And they don't acquire that productive knowledge because it's not a single piece of knowledge that they need. They need a whole set of person bites. And the the incentives of any individual to learn a one person byte is limited by the fact that all the other complementary person bytes are absent, so that demand for his person byte won't be there. And that's what slows down the whole process. So I would put it to you that I don't think I'm oversimplifying. I'm trying to create a language in which we understand how the many things have to be there for things to happen.
I think we should come back to you on that, because surely, what about the example of India? They're making medicines. They've got all the bits together.
Well, you know, if you rank India from the richest to the poorest, the top 55 million Indians are richer than the 55 million French. So there is a France in India, right? And so there is, but India is, you know, is a huge continent. Knowledge has not spread within India.
Okay. Next three questions. One question here, please, and then we'll take one from this right-hand side. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to ask the last speaker. I'm Nguyen from Vietnam. I think this last speaker, Mr. Volker, the last line, I have seen that the GM crop, gene modified crop. I think this now is the big debate in Swiss Asia, because when we, you know, the impact of climate change, so we need the, you know, the new screening, you know, the crop tied up the soil tolerant or the viruses tolerant. And I know that the European Union is non-expand this research, but in the West and other country, I think this research, and I think we need to see that what is the program for future. If I have seen that the last line that you have the gene modified crop program collaboration with some other, I think it's very important now. What we can identify the program and what we identify the next step, how to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next question on behind you. Yeah, thank you.
I'm Florence from the University of Mexico. This is a question addressed to Professor Hausmann. I gather that in your last remark, you said that PK was more important than education for fostering the development of a country. Could you comment on that?
And another question just in front of... Oh, there's a question at the back there.
Thank you very much. Martin Taylor, Ocean Networks, Canada. Implicit in a number of the comments has been the need for physical infrastructure to support knowledge production. We have one International Space Station, we have one CERN, we all have personal computers. There's a huge range in between. How do we determine the cost effectiveness in the context of international collaboration of having big research facilities? How many do we need? How many of those should be organized internationally? Which should be indeed nationally or regionally distributed? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Bircher, would you like to take that last question? Coming up.
I think this is a key question to which I have no clear and easy answer. Let me just start with the example of the European Union. As I have told you, we are in a situation where we have 27 member states with academies of sciences at the level of the member states, with a European Union that has a proper research program. We have regions who still do research and innovation. So there are two issues. On the one hand, we are supposed to be a European research area, but within this European research area, there is still, on the one hand, competitiveness amongst the actors. That is one feature. The other feature, it is certainly true that there is a hell of a lot of synergies you can make in terms of money and human resources if you determine your research agenda together. I think when our commissioner has started, she was questioned by the European Parliament. And her first remark was, is it really normal that we have, when I looked in Google, immediately discovered 70 studies about Salmonella in Europe? Maybe they were a little bit differentiated, I do not know. So really the question here is, how much do we need to do together, still respecting the competitiveness aspects of every and single one, and on the other hand, where can we share common research funding and dissemination? I must say I'm quite surprised when it comes to sharing research and knowledge, if you look what the European car industry has done. You would consider that this is a highly competitive industry where they try to keep secrets as much as possible for themselves. However, in the framework of one of our initiatives, they have created a common platform for research, the EUCAR initiative, where they work together on the longevity of batteries and these kind of things. So there is a very high degree of possibilities to still work together. We have another example in Europe, and I think you refer to this, is the European research infrastructure. But evidently, you can ask the same question at the worldwide level. How far do we need to go in these questions? I have no reply to it, but it's a very challenging issue because we have just embarked on discussion on the European research area. And European research area means, should we not more share our common research agenda, doing things much more together? And I have said at the beginning, the same questions arises at the worldwide level because the societal challenges are the same. I have no reply, but it's a challenging question.
Thank you very much. If I could just respond briefly on the GM crop issue, we have a remarkable situation that has developed. The fastest uptake of any agricultural technology in the history of agriculture, very big uptake in East Asia, in China, Southeast Asia, India, very big uptake in South America and North America, and right in the middle we have Europe and many African countries that have so far adopted the precautionary principle and therefore that is not developed in these parts. So we have an extraordinary tension developing, which is something that many people are giving a lot of thought to as to how this is going to be resolved in the future. So the last response is from Professor Hausmann. I think this is the last response from the panel.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the question on productive knowledge versus schooling. Now, let me tell you, I'm in the schooling business, so I'm not going to talk against my own business. But let me try to highlight what's the difference between one and the other one. The typical way we measure schooling is by years of schooling. And because quality varies, we have these standardized exams like the PISA exam or the TIMSS exam to measure how much, essentially, of the same curriculum or of the same set of skills people have acquired. So in some sense, that's an intensive measure of how much knowledge people have. Productive knowledge is an extensive measure. It measures how different is the knowledge that people have, not how similar it is, not how many years of the same curriculum people have, but how different are the sets of knowledge that people have. So it's a different measure. It's orthogonal, if you want, to the intensive measure of how much people have. Now, much of it is really held in the process of production, in firms and organizations and corporations, where all this tacit knowledge resides and people accumulated, not through years of schooling, but through years of experience. Now, in one of the charts I didn't show, I was contrasting Ghana with Thailand. Ghana is a country that did much more in schooling than Thailand. But Thailand accumulated much more productive knowledge because they turned into making electronics, cars, machines, and a bunch of other things, which means that that knowledge is held in those organizations that are making things. And it's very poorly captured by just how many years of schooling people went through. Now, there might be some complementarity between one and the other, but the econometrics suggest that what's really driving the story is this diversity of knowledge, not this intensity of knowledge. Thank you.
Last word.
One of the things that often comes up in this discussion about schooling and also the previous discussion about R&D, and I just want to contrast this, is that we often focus on inputs. How much money are we spending on R&D? How many years of education? And what we're focusing, Professor Hausmann is focusing on is the outputs, and how can we measure that? And I would encourage all of us to not assume that inputs, you know, R&D spending, schooling necessarily leads to innovation or to technological advance or economic progress.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you feel the experiment worked, which we started at the beginning, and shall we applaud our panel?